Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk about networking. Today is part two of a show on network hardware and what goes on inside your switch. You would have already listened to network hardware part one by now, and we're going to pick up where we left off on the previous show. Joining us again today is Simon Chatterjee. Hi, Simon. Tell people a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Greg. I've been doing router software and system architecture for quite a few years, especially on the high-end router end of the line.
Thanks very much for joining us this week and giving us your time. And also with us again is John Harrington. John.
Hey, Greg. Yeah, my name is John Harrington. I'm a senior network test engineer working for a large service provider. Yeah, I'm coming at this from the user perspective and the test perspective, so get to dig underneath the hood a little bit.
And as always, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters is at etherealmind. And I'm the relatively ignorant one here. I think what we might just do is push right on into the conversation and pick up where we last got to. We just finished talking about the different types of chips inside of a switch, the CPUs, the ASICs, the NPUs, and the FPGAs. And what we want to start doing now is saying that now we've built the board that's player spies are plugged in, there's interfaces with QSFPs and all that sort of stuff. What happens when the packet comes in? What happens in the root lookup phase?
So you've got a packet that arrives at the interface and you've got to route it. Well, the first question is, what type of packet is this? Is this a control packet or is this a packet destined for another port or a packet you want to route or switch? This conversation can go very different ways depending on the type of packet it is. If it's a control packet, we've got to get it to the CPU for processing. For now, let's leave that aside. That's a slightly different conversation. Hopefully that has happened already. You've figured out your OSPF or your STP topology, you've got your hardware programmed, and now you need to process it, get the packet through the system. So we've got a data plane packet or a packet destined for another address arrives on your front panel interface. So that will arrive on a SFP interface, which will convert it from a laser or from an optical signal into an electrical signal, and it will try and get that signal to the ASIC. It will arrive at the ASIC, so layer two, it'll be processed by the MAC function on the ASIC and will be quickly placed in a buffer. Now, Simon, tell me if I'm kind of oversimplifying this, but basically the entire packet may be placed in a buffer depending on how you do this. Let's assume for now that we're doing store and forward. We get a chance to look at the entire packet or frame before we make our forwarding decision. There is the cut through alternative, but let's keep that aside for now. You've stored your packet in a buffer or a series of cells or fixed size buffers in your, I guess it would be, what would it be, Simon? It'd be DRAM or RAM, a form of volatile memory.
Yeah.
So we've got that there. And I guess I had a question on my blog the other day where somebody asked me to explain, what happens here. Is the entire frame forwarded, so the user assumed to the CPU, or is the entire frame processed? And unless you're doing a very deep packet inspection and typically on a merchant silicon platform, you won't be. You'll just want to examine the headers. That entire packet will be placed in a series of linked buffers, and it will have a unique ID for that packet. That unique ID plus the header will then go on and be processed by, the packet processing engine. I guess it's the heart of the switch-on-chip ASIC. So assume it was a Trident ASIC. There's a pipeline or a series of steps that you would go through to classify the packet, to look it up, to consult the forwarding memory, to consult the forwarding tables, pick a destination port for it. For all of these stages, we can go down in lots of detail, but for now, I guess we should keep it relatively high level. At that point, you need to choose your egress. Assume you've done your forwarding lookup. You've chosen an egress port, a next hop IP address. In Cisco parlance, you're in your FIB here. Look up. And next, you need to find out, well, I've got a next hop IP address. Well, the question is what's the MAC address of that? Is there any encapsulation needed? Cisco would call that the adjacency table. So we do a lookup of the adjacency table. Now, that is typically in a different type of memory. It's a simpler lookup. You pick your egress port. You pick your you have your destination MAC address. You calculate a new checksum. You just send the packet out the destination port. I know it's never that simple. That's a quick overview, we can go dig down deeper in some of those stages.
Simon, I think one thing that I thought I read somewhere was once the packet's actually received and handled by the network processor, they actually put an internal header on it so that as it routes around the internal fabric, it's got its own routing information.
That's right. Yeah, you need some metadata about the packet to know what to do with it. So, for example, the port number it came in on, you need to know. Because, for example, if you've got a switch maybe on one port, you treat every frame of that port unconditionally as layer 2 forwarding. So you ignore the IP address, you ignore VLAN tags, you just do a MAC lookup straight away. Okay. For another port, maybe you classify by VLAN, and one VLAN is doing layer 3 and one VRF, another VLAN is doing layer 3, another VRF, another is doing layer 2. So you need to know what port it came in on. You kind of correlate that with the configuration per port and maybe look down the VLAN stack. And then you finally work out what exactly am I supposed to be doing with this packet? What path am I taking? And then, of course, what features as well. And so that the header on the packet internally contains all the metadata you need to do all that kind of function.
I always wondered what the metadata did. I knew it was something, but I hadn't actually heard it turned into, like, does the input in... I hadn't thought about what is the input data, like whether it's a VRF or the native interface or VLAN tagged or whether it's being routed in the global table or not. I guess NAT information as well, various things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the feature chain that's been configured for that sort of packet, you need to be able to look up from that.
The packet then moves across the internal architecture based on that internal header then?
Yeah, that's right. And so, for example, when you're doing the route lookup, maybe you've determined there what the egress interface is. Mm. So maybe at that point you write that into the buffer header, into the packet header internally, and then maybe that just sits as it flows through maybe the ACL and QoS processing, and then finally when it comes out the other side, you then look that up and send it out the right port at the end.
But that header never leaves the box. It's all it's injected, added on the outside of the frame, if you like. It's not part of the frame. It's usually...
Right. It's purely internal. And you have headers go chip to chip, across the fabric and it's stripped off. So, but there's a core that goes all the way from the input to the output.
The packet's actually got like a flag. It runs around with a little flag with information on it that tells all the chips in the path.
Exactly. It's kind of like tunneling with, the packet level. Yeah.
Hmm. Now that we've talked about what's happening with the packet itself, let's throw that over. Let's have a look about the memory. Because when you're doing that lookup, DRAM's relatively slow. I mean, it's measured in terms of milliseconds. And what we need is a type of memory that can do a lookup at very, very, very fast speed. So, John, tell us a little bit about what that memory looks like.
In a modern commodity-based switch-on-chip architecture, generally the forwarding tables will be performed by a TCAM or ternary CAM. Now, that's not the only option. There are ways of doing it that don't involve this type of specialist memory. TCAM is a very complex type of memory. It is content addressable, which means, I guess, try to pull the value from it by... Let's talk about the way it works, actually. That might work a little bit better. When you look up a prefix in TCAM, and you normally use it for longest prefix matches. So you could have, for any prefix lookup for any host, you could match 0/0, you could match 192.168/16, you could match 192.168.124/24. You could have at least three matches for any particular prefix when you look it up. And TCAM is set up so that you can match all of those prefixes at one time. The order in which the TCAM is processed allows you to pick the most specific match. So TCAM is this like magic memory in it, and there is a cost for it. But it's this magic memory where you can use one cycle and you can look up the correct destination, find the correct prefix match and the longest prefix match for a particular destination IP address in one CPU cycle. And that is incredible. That's an incredibly powerful piece of hardware. And if you are interested, go look it up. There's loads of resources on the net, or I've written about it. It's really cool tech, but it comes at quite a cost, right?
It does, because it's built out of SRAMs.
Yeah.
So static RAMs, it's not DRAMs. The chips are permanently charged, so they're always sucking gas. Simon, you want to expand on that?
Yeah, so as John says, TCAM's a really cool tech, but they come with some limitations. So they have a very fixed size, and normally you reuse the TCAM for multiple purposes. Use it for MAC lookups, for route lookups, for classifications, for things like QoS or ACLs, for a bunch of things. And so you have to manage the resource kind of carefully. And if you need one more than what you got, just kind of out of luck. When you need sort of super high scale with kind of the routers, then you tend to go for RAM-based, tree-based structures for things like prefix lookups. But as you said, Greg, normal DRAM you know, takes tens of nanoseconds to do a lookup. You can't just use that in a normal way. So you have to work really hard with some combination of clever design and multiple banks and exotic sorts of RAM to make that go fast enough. But if you do that, you're kind of much more scalable.
Probably got parallel RAM banks and optimized data structures in DRAM to make that work. You've written here RL.
Yeah.
I've never heard of RL DRAM before in the notes.
So that's, I think John mentioned, reduce latency DRAM. That's one example where kind of it's kind of a known industry part today, where it's kind of a fancy RAM that's a bit faster. Now, there's always been different variants of this as you go year by year, some of which are market-based, some of which are proprietary. And pretty much a big router will probably use one of those to make it go fast enough.
So this is where we come to this thing like a router has a maximum size of the BGP routing table, is because that RAM table is of a finite size. So you can't have more than, you know, 500,000 routes or 1,000,000 routes in the BGP table, because that's the maximum size of that memory table.
Right, and you normally get maybe hundreds of thousands if you're using a big TCAM, and tens of millions if you're using a big state-of-the-art RAM try. But either way, you eventually hit a limit. Yeah.
The important thing here is that, you know, you've got an address or a MAC address on the left side, and you're trying to find the output port in the lookup table. Because really the only thing the router needs to know is that I've received it. Where has it got to go next? What's the output? So the root lookup is actually, or the MAC address lookup is, here's my destination root or my destination IP, or here's my destination MAC. Which output port does that belong to? And that's what the purpose of the lookup is to achieve. If you delay that in any way, then the packet can't then be forwarded across the switch. It has to wait until that lookup's done before it can leave the input port. The time gap between a frame being received and then the next frame arriving is down towards the nanosecond level. It's very, 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 very limited time between receiving packets before it has to clear the input interface, unless you have input buffers. But even then, input buffers can overrun within 100 nanoseconds, because at 10 gigabits per second, it's like, even 8 megabits is like 100 packets or something. It's really quite extraordinary, isn't it, Simon?
Yeah, that's right. So you kind of end up with sort of a choice. Either you just try and get rid of the packet as quickly as possible, in which case you use kind of exotic memory to do that, or you kind of use cheaper memory sort of in clever ways, and you have to hide the latency by, as you say, queuing up more packets, having a pipeline of more packets in flight at once on that network, on that bit of silicon, and kind of, you know, the delay for the lookup to happen is kind of hidden by doing other processing in the other packets at the same time. And, you know, what trade-off you get there depends on what you're trying to achieve with the switch or router.
Yeah, that sounds complicated. When you, the more complex it gets, the more I hear hard. So that's a good one.
There is an engineering point here that is that, you know, to know which memory is being used in your network or in your network hardware, you know, to know what type of platform you have. Like if you've got TCAM, if your forwarding engine is based on, your route lookup is based on TCAM, then that's probably internal TCAM, that's probably sitting in the switch on chip, and it is extremely limited. Now, it's extremely fast, extremely powerful, but you've got a very low number of prefixes. So you just need to know what you're using. And I've come across situations where you had a promised, like, you know, say, for example, the silicon says I can do 16,000 prefixes, but the vendor says you can do 32,000 prefixes. And it turned out that what they meant was you could have 16,000 longest prefix matches, which meant TCAM, you know, you could do, you know, subnet matches, and you could have 16,000 host routes, which were /32s. And that's, you know, that's a much simpler lookup you can do. And basically that's using a different type of memory in the switch to do that, because it's like an adjacency table. You have a fixed bit length prefix, and you're just looking to match exactly that. You're not trying to compare different prefix lengths and pick the best. So the reason I bring this up is
they call that the binary cam.
That is a binary cam, yeah. That is a straightforward cam, or it might be a linked list or a hash table to do the same thing. But it uses a much less expensive part of the memory, so it has the potential to mislead. Let's put it that way. You need to know, like all vendor presentations, you need to be asking specific questions about, you know, when somebody says I can do X prefixes, you ask, are there any constraints? you know, is there anything I need to be looking out for here? Is it 32 prefixes of, or you know, 32,000 prefixes of any length? Are there any restrictions? So it's one of those areas where hardware knowledge really does lead to better engineering decisions. At the very least, a less embarrassing meeting with your manager when you realize that your network is blown up. So just bear it in mind.
Yeah. That's right. So most switches, as I understand it, is there's often a binary cam and a ternary cam. The binary cam does an exact match, which is very useful for MAC addresses. So because what you do is you pass in the MAC address as a key and you get the output port number back from it in one clock cycle. And I mean, you're talking nanoseconds there. And in ternary cam, you pass in a subnet. Right, you've got a destination IP, which will be part of a subnet. So you want to do a partial match on the address because the last 8 bytes might not matter, right, in a /24. And that's the difference between a binary cam and a ternary cam. But the circuitry required to make a ternary cam, which has part matching, is 3 times or 4 times more complicated than a binary cam. And yeah, some people quote the 16K in a binary cam and 16K in a TCAM. They're both IP routes because you can match a /32 because you don't have to match the unknown bit. That's a real catch, that, isn't it? That'd have been a bad day.
And the vendor isn't wrong. It's just you haven't asked a specific enough question.
Yeah, that's right. They're not lying to you. They just don't understand your needs.
We're being kind here, yeah.
Yeah, I was being very polite, I thought there. So, Simon, packet buffers, this sounds like something that you're really good. We've got a packet coming in, we've done the lookup, or we've got a delay on the lookup. What happens with packet buffers when it comes in off the CERDES?
Yeah, so as John said, basically when the packet comes in, you kind of normally split it into a head and a tail, and you stick the tail off in the buffer until you're ready to send the packet out again, and you process just on the head, and that's where you add you do your lookups, you add any encapsulation or take away any decapsulation, that kind of stuff. The main packet buffers that again matter most from a sort of device perspective are really the packet buffers, you know, it's buffering packets before they come out of an egress port. These kind of vary wildly in size. If you get a switch made as cheap as possible, it's going to have really small buffers. If you get a more reassuring and expensive one, it can have buffers where, you know, they're much bigger. In terms of how it works under the covers, as John said, they basically split the packet into normally fixed-size chunks and you map them in and then read them out again on the way out again. You're never going to get pure 100% usage of the packet buffer memory. It's going to be a little bit wastage depending on the exact size of packets come in and how much, you know, rewriting that gets bigger or smaller you do. But yeah, that's the primary function of the packet buffer. And the main problem there is just to say the memory bandwidth. If you think you've got let's say one piece of forwarding silicon could be saying, you know, do 200 gig in, 200 gig out. That means every second there are 400 billion ones and zeros being written into the buffer and 400 billion ones and zeros being read out of the buffer, even if there's no congestion whatsoever. So there's a large amount of memory bandwidth required, which means you have to engineer the system kind of carefully to make that cost effective.
Kind of carefully. Comedy gold. I mean, and then I've also heard of, so in the old days, packet buffers were static, right? Each interface would have a memory allocated to that interface. And so, but this is changing, right? So in the old days, this interface would have, you know, 48K of buffer or 48 megs of buffer or something. It varies according to the hardware platform and how much money is invested and how you manage the buffers and all that sort of thing. But 8 megs, for example, was what was on a 6500 module that I used to know something about. But each port had 8 megs and it was fixed. But over here was the port that was doing the uplink. And what you really wanted was to have the memory that was allocated to it to be deeper because it was the only port that was congested. And so people now have lots of math going on looking at packet at the memory and saying, well, what if I was to reassign some of the memory to the port that's being heavily used? And that's called dynamic packet buffering. Is that true, Simon?
Yeah, very much so. And of course, you can never go beyond the scope of one chip. So if you had, say, you know, 3 port chips servicing, you know, a 48-port switch or something, you can each will have its own buffer memory attached per chip. But yeah, within that, kind of stat mixing across those is obviously better if you can do it.
Yeah, so dynamically covering up the buffer according to what it is. But keep in mind that there has to be maths there to predict which port needs which memory. And then blah, blah, blah. That there's magic, I think, going on at about that point. But things like that's really complicated. So the buffering thing is a definite differentiation between the low-end switches, which often have these fixed packet buffers, and you can have an uplink port which can overrun its packet buffers even though the other ones aren't being used, which is a little bit non-obvious. But in the more complicated systems like the chassis and the, you know, where the reassuringly expensive price tag comes with extra magic on these buffers, they start to do dynamic packet buffering or have deeper packet buffers. So they're very low. And some of them even have high latency modes where you can turn it on so that the algorithms don't allow packet buffers at all. You can say basically disable them down to some minimum level because you'd rather throw packets away than have them sit in the packet buffers for more than 15 milliseconds or something, or 50 nanoseconds or whatever it is that meets your complete goals. Again, what John said earlier, hardware goals is where you need to be.
There is no formula that tells you exactly what the right packet buffering requirements are for your that point in the network. There's some sort of just kind of knowing for the application. On kind of WAN ports, for example, there used to be this rule of thumb that you needed the round trip time times the bandwidth so you could fill up the fiber, given the speed of light, with packets with the buffer in order to not make TCP slow down. And then a few years ago, this research saying, well, actually, if that's carrying multiple flows, well, actually, you can cut back on the buffering because you're averaging that across multiple flows. But kind of even so, you tend to need fairly big buffers on the router ports anyway, just to get the memory bandwidth through. Point being, there's no easy formula. You need to kind of work it out.
And it varies from hardware to hardware, CPUs, memory, clock cycles, network process. So that's magic. But just be aware that packet buffers are, there's usually enhanced magic going on inside there, is what I think of it.
Exactly. And part of the, part of what you pay for is the magic.
We've talked about packet buffers, and that's where the advanced magic is happening. So we need to move into what's happening with the forwarding. So how does the packet actually move across the buffer? What magic is happening there? Simon, talk to me about what access lists, cross operations, and so forth.
Yes, we've talked about the absolute bare bones of what it takes to forward a packet out the right egress port with the right rewrite. But obviously, in a lot of cases, you want to do a lot more than that. So things like cross or access lists, or you might need a URPF check on the source address, or that kind of jazz. So there's normally a lot more capability in the forwarding path than just the plain packet forwarding. And so to do that, there's a bunch of things you need to do. One is you need to classify the packet to work out what to do with it. For example, applying an access list, you're asking the router to classify the packet as to whether it meets the list or not. And if it does, do certain operations, and not if it doesn't. So there's classification, normally using things like ports and protocol numbers and layer 437 identifiers, as well as the layer 2 and layer 3. This is often done using TCAMs, where again, you load up the TCAM with not just the destination identifier, but also all this extra layer 3, layer 4 data to see if it matches. It's like the only way. There is sort of moderately clever mathematics you can do where you can just kind of load up a sort of 20 question style decision tree. If you know this is the classification criteria you care about, you know, compose some sort of minimal binary decision tree that a purely sort of a software element can go through with fast memory and do the classification through. But TCAMs are the main one.
Mm-hmm. That explains it for me then. There used to be a thing where when you started to invoke access lists and policy-based routing, the TCAM would shrink by a corresponding amount against the routing table. So I guess what they were doing is starting to slice off, as you started to add more packet processing, like policy-based routing and QoS operations, it was actually taking TCAM away from the routing table.
That's exactly right. And obviously, TCAM is a strictly finite resource, so if this is your policy, you have to share it amongst all the functions for the TCAM. Yeah. And if you do the other approach, then the problem is kind of less rigid. Maybe if you add one more rule, you won't overflow TCAM. You might just get a slower decision tree, but that means your forwarding can become kind of non-deterministic. So you kind of pick your poison, what you think is best for that point in the network. Mm-hmm. So there's a classification element given the configuration and given the packet where you decide what to do with all these other operations like access lists or QoS. Once you've decided what to do with the packet, then you could be invoking other hardware features like QoS polices or meters or other lookups like kind of jazz. So once you've done the features as well as the actual raw forwarding, one thing to notice, some features are a lot worse than others. So kind of like the way graphics cards are much faster than general purpose CPUs at pushing lots of pixels, they kind of make the assumption that one pixel only requires a moderate amount of computation and largely doesn't depend very much on the other pixels on the screen, so you can parallelize it. And kind of for packet forwarding hardware, we often make the same assumption. You can treat one packet kind of independently of another one, and that lets you sort of spread out over the silicon and use parallel paths. And so there are some features where that assumption breaks, meaning that one packet's forwarding affects another. So it's really stateful features, like stateful firewalls or NATs or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So whenever you turn on those features, you're necessarily making life hardware sort of harder for the hardware, because it's going to have to, you know, save information and make sure one packet has updated it before processing another. And particularly if you want to sync the dynamic state to a standby device for things like firewall, and that, again, that's obviously a big burden.
No, HA
payload. So packet forwarding features are easiest. Yeah, exactly. So packet forwarding features, we try to make as much as possible them independent packet by packet. The main thing we do is make sure that individual flows don't get reordered. But other than that, try and treat each packet individually. But when you do turn stateful features on, you're going to make life harder and you're going to kind of go slower or impose more cost.
And then shaping, packet shaping. So especially like HQoS, which is hierarchical queuing, which is QoS within QoS within QoS. I mean, the original design behind the seven layers of QoS was to keep it nice and simple, and so you could just carve up your packet buffers into seven pieces and then put and then service each of those queues. But HQoS breaks that, doesn't it, and turns it into something that must be really difficult inside the box.
Yeah, HQoS is a really difficult computation problem, especially when you do all the things that you actually really do into things like priority queues and minimum bandwidth guarantees and fair sharing of excess bandwidth and all that kind of thing. It's a really difficult computational problem, and one where a normal sequential CPU like an x86 is just really poorly suited to, because it's obviously seeing this really, you know, big tree of decision points of what to do with the next packet. And even, you know, things like microcoded MPUs, again, it's really no good. To do this make this go well, you really need dedicated silicon that just sits there with a hierarchical queue of packets and does the right thing. So when the next space appears in the output port, it makes a decision what's the next packet to go out, given all this complex queuing and criteria you've loaded up into it. So that's one area where you really, the silicon to do that, whether it's embedded on the single ASIC or the net processor or separate ASIC, kind of looks nothing like you see on a regular PC or other devices, but is really essential to get good throughput today.
We talked earlier about the turning on particular features and that having an impact on the hardware. One of the things I've noticed is that I think Simon mentioned URPF, or unicast reverse path forwarding. So that's the ability to check the source as well as the destination, to basically to do a lookup on both source and dest and make a decision based on that. But, you know, one of the things there is we talked about finite resource in the TCAM. If you've got an ASIC that has got a fixed pipeline, i.e. the set of decisions that it has to go through are fixed, you can't tell it to, oh, you know, circle back around and check the source again. You know, you've got to do one lookup. You get one chance to do a lookup. So the implication there is that if you're going to turn on URPF, basically you need to burn two entries in your TCAM. So basically you need to check the source and dest in one clock cycle, because the ASIC doesn't have the flexibility to go back and check again. The ASIC gets one chance at lookup. So the implication of turning on one feature halves your longest prefix match capacity on the box. So again, it's one of those areas where, yeah, knowing those features and feature penalties based on the hardware type that you have is very important. And the other thing was the concept of SDM prefer. And I was never quite sure what it was. People who've used the 3750 type switch from Cisco will be hopefully will be familiar with it. If you're not, you should check what your setting is. But basically, this is the ability to carve up at boot time. So basically, you got to carve up at boot time the allocation of resources in those TCAM between doing, you know, URPF, or I think policy-based routing is another. You can do IPv6, IPv4, and there's loads of different profiles that you can set that carve up ahead of time how you're using that, you know, precious TCAM resource. And again, that's one of those things that unfortunately isn't reflected in your running configuration either. So you definitely need to be checking this, because, you know, it's part of the identity of your box, right?
Yeah.
You will get some nasty surprises if you don't know what that is and you do a swap out of a box. No. So again, that's a user users don't normally get to choose. Users normally actually get plenty of whatever resource it is, but there are times when you might be using, say, a 3750 as an edge router or something innovative like that. But you know, if you don't watch your hardware resources and watch what you're engineering to, you can get a nasty surprise there. So yeah, just a one to watch out for, but definitely directly related to the utilization of TCAM.
That should wrap up the discussion around the forwarding features. Just to give you some insight into the complexities of some of the fancy stuff that happens inside of a router, or fancy routing as I call it, where you munge with access lists or QoS and stuff like that. Let's talk a little bit more. We talked earlier in the previous show about non-volatile memory and flash modules and how it works, and we covered out that bootloaders, when the box boots, it usually reads a BIOS to do a preliminary load before it passes over to boot an operating system. Now, in the new era, what we're seeing is that there are a lot of companies out there who are making open source operating systems for switches. So we're seeing there's an open network Linux from Big Switch who are championing the cause. Cumulus Linux, of course, has their version of Linux for routing. And they have a bootloading initiative called ONIE. I'll just pause here. Who was it that put in the ONIE? Tell me a little bit about what you understand about ONIE at this point.
Yeah, so as far as I know, ONIE is an open compute initiative. I think it was pushed by the Cumulus Linux guys. So they're basically saying, hey, look, how about on a network device, you have a bootloader choice the same way you would have for Grub or Lilo if you've got a familiarity with Linux. You just get to choose the OS that you boot, and you have network boot options. That's kind of like Pixie Boot as well. And basically, the whole idea here with ONIE is that you get a little bit more transparency. You get more choice. You always had a bootloader, but you had one choice, right? You got to pick which of your vendor images you loaded. Now, the idea with ONIE, or I guess what is the open network install environment. So basically, it's about, this is kind of part of the commoditization drive, or at least, you know, the bit where you say, hey, wouldn't it be nice to have a choice, assuming I've bought a white box or bare metal switch, that I got a choice as to what OS I booted. Now, I don't know how many choices there are in the market right now, but definitely it seems to be a common sense initiative to say, hey, look, give people access to the bootloader, let them choose which OS they boot, and to do it in a standardized way. It's nothing new. It's existed in Linux and operating systems for quite a while, but it is new to networking. It's more of a market-changing initiative than really a strong technology.
You want to explain the difference between, and I think this is interesting, the concept of using Linux for networking as compared to some other operating systems.
Yeah, so you see a variety of kind of underlying software architectures for the code that runs on the CPU or CPUs inside the system. The older ones tend to have kind of proprietary kernels that schedule tasks and manage kind of timers and let the different competing processes that wanting to do compute, you know, manage the physical CPU resource. So things like VxWorks is one of the older ones that kind of, there's no memory protection between processes. And whereas these days, you know, increasingly using either a Unix or literally a Linux kernel to give you, you know, these core, you know, barriers between processes, so a bug in your OSPF, say, isn't going to bring down your SSH or your BGP. Within that, though, there's still quite a wide variety of approaches. Some vendors take, for example, say, FreeBSD or Linux kernel and enhance the kernel itself. So the code that runs inside the special supervisor mode to have certain other features that make it better for routing. Other vendors treat the underlying kernel is purely a kind of, it's just there to abstract the hardware. It gives you process walls, it gives you threads, it gives you timers, that kind of thing. But all the code that actually matters runs purely as user-space process, even the TCP/IP stack, the driver for all the ASICs, that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I had this described to me by somebody, and I said to them, you know, fundamentally, the Linux isn't actually driving the data plane, it's not driving the ASICs that we talked about. It's got, not, you know, there's a device driver which the Linux talks down to the chips. And so there's a process, and even the networking software that's in the Linux isn't running as Linux in user space. It's actually off in its own little thing. So things like BGP processes and OSPF and ISIS, they're not Linux programs. They're very specialist other programs that sort of Linux just tells them to start, and then off they go and do something over there as device drivers or something like that. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So, for example, if you're kind of producing, if you can maybe a startup doing a chip, you know, a system quickly, you're going to use all of Linux. So if you do, for example, show ARP or ARP on the Linux shell, that's going to give you the same output as if you do show ARP on your CLI or your NetConf, whatever you have. Mm. On one of the more kind of more elaborate systems, then the ARP and Linux kernel would be, you know, almost empty, or maybe have some minimal information just about how the system itself glues together. Mm. The actual ARP functionality and process, it's way up in user space, nothing to do with Linux. You're really using Linux just as a kind of an infrastructure on which to run the code you care about. You don't really care what Linux thinks.
Linux is just there to sort of act as an interface out to the real world. All of the mainstream code is like buried in the back somewhere where you can't actually get to it. But as you say, some people using just Linux to do a lot of the networking functions, more like an x86 with a couple of gigabit interfaces, and there's degrees of complexity and cost.
Very much so. I mean, so if you need something quickly, then for example, using what's in Linux, you know, makes sense. But you know, the routing and switching in Linux is, you know, not best in class. Although it's great, it's open, but has limitations. It means that if, say, a, you know, security issue appears where, say, I don't know, say the way the Linux kernel handles an ARP packet, there's an issue, well, then your box becomes vulnerable. Whereas if everything's up in user space, then you don't really care about that, but it's more expensive in terms of what you're trying to do. And if there's a, you want to upgrade your software, you can just restart that process, you don't need to restart the whole kernel or the whole CPU. Mm. So there's trade-offs in terms of what you get versus the complexity of writing software that way.
It's not always obvious what the differences are. I don't know that people always understand that piece of it, you know, that it's not really Linux in a lot of ways, it's something else. And ONIE is the operating system. It's, we're trying to come up with a standard way to boot the rest of the operating system. So in the same way that, you know, an ordinary x86 server can boot Windows or Linux or, you know, in the old days, more esoteric operating systems, the ONIE is, allows us to choose to boot different versions of Linux, or it gives us a standardized way to boot operating systems on networking devices in the future.
Pretty much.
It's quite hopeful, though, because it does, as somebody once said, I mean, the idea behind wanting to boot your own operating system is that, and this is an image, this is a marketing position espoused by a couple of different companies now, is that you could buy hardware from company A and run software from company B. If you fall out of love with company B, you can go and buy company C software and run it on the same hardware. If you fall out of love with the hardware from company A, change to company D for hardware, but use company B's software. Your software doesn't have to change. So you get that flexibility. Now, it's yet to be seen if the traditional approach to network engineering, where the software and the hardware came from a single place, as to whether that's better or, you know, or better for a price, might be the best way to put it. You know, as Simon points out, there's reassuringly expensive. You know, the more expensive you get, the more engineering goes in, the cleverer the design, the faster the performance, the more the capability. And today, the Linux, you know, these open Linux environments do work, but they do have some limitations, and this is what part of what led to this discussion. So let's move on to the next topic and start to talk about what's happening on the physical ports themselves. John?
So you've got a lot of choice here. I think we talked earlier and we said that the ports are the cages, there's little metal enclosures for your front panel interfaces, are increasingly taking up a huge amount of space if you looked under the hood on your pizza box switch or any line card, for example, would be the same. The most common port, I guess, that I would see at the moment is a 10 gig port. You know, you'll see 40 gig ports, so you see 1 gig ports. But really, from an ASIC perspective, and I guess from a switch layout perspective, there really isn't that much difference between the speeds. Every transceiver, say an SFP plus transceiver, which is a pretty small transceiver, there could be 24, 48, maybe even 96 of those ports on the front of your switch. Basically, all the SFP is doing, or the transceiver is doing, is taking a signal, which is usually a laser signal, but doesn't have to be. It could be an electrical signal, a twin axis signal. And it basically converts it into a format that's suitable for transmission to the ASIC. You know, you've got a signal that's transited maybe 300 meters, could have been 10 kilometers, 40 kilometers. The job of the link and the transceiver is to do most of the signal process, most of the signal conditioning, to pass the electrical signal and send it to the ASIC in as good a quality as it can. Once it gets onto that circuit board, then the problems start. You know, that's yes, the signal may have transited, you know, 10 kilometers over single mode fiber, but that was a very protected environment for the signal. It was highly engineered. Yes, it will have incurred, you know, power loss, maybe not dispersion for single mode, but it suffered some distortion. The 7 inches or so that it needs to go to get to the CPU, or that would be allowed for it, for it to get to the ASIC, is that's the real challenging time. Sometimes between the connector or the cage that the SFP plus transceiver, say, connects into, between it and the ASIC, there might be a signal conditioning chip. Now, I'm making things very simple here because we're assuming like the signal that comes out the back of a SFP Plus is still a serial encoded signal. We haven't converted it to a parallel signal. We don't need to do serial to parallel conversion or anything like that. So I'm taking the easy example here. But even still, you may need to clean up and boost that signal before it gets to the ASIC, or the ASIC may not be able to recover the signal. It may not be able to, you know, interpret what the one and zero pattern was, what was encoded on the wire. I call them signal conditioning chips. Now, basically, they're chips that clean up and boost the signal.
Yeah. So what comes in on the wire can often be distorted in transmission. The square corners on the signal get distorted.
You're pretty much guaranteed that's...
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be nasty. The signal that arrives at the ASIC is not the signal you transmitted. So sometimes you will need one of these signal conditioning chips. Now, some people call them PHY chips, and some people call them SerDes chips, or serial to serial deserial. So to do a serial to parallel conversion. Now, I think the name can be misleading, right? So the PHY refer to the PHY layer, the physical layer functionality. You know, a signaling conditioning chip may implement some of those functions or may not. So you need to look at what the type of signaling conditioning chip that you have. I guess it doesn't really matter to users that much. But SerDes as well, people call them SerDes. And if it's an SFI signal, sorry, SFI is the signal that comes out of an SFP Plus transceiver. And SFI is just an electrical specification. It just, like, here's the parameters that need to exist on this circuit trace as the signal goes from the front panel port to the ASIC. There's no magic in those. Those words, SFI, XFI, etc., they just kind of confuse. I probably shouldn't have even mentioned it. But anyway, that's the format of the signal as it goes from A to, as it goes from port.
So there might be chips in the baseboard there that do, signal comes up off the QSFP, goes into a serializer deserializer, which is what, because the signal coming in on the wire is sequential, one after the bit after bit after bit. But internally on the motherboard, it goes into parallel lines. So an 8-bit signal, which is...
Maybe. It, like, for if it's an SFP Plus signal and you have... Well, it depends on the capability of your ASIC. Let's put it that way. If your ASIC can terminate an SFI signal, which is the signal that comes out of an SFP Plus transceiver, then you don't need a serial deserializer. You don't need a SerDes function, because the ASIC itself can handle a serial signal. But if you've got an older ASIC that can only support ZAUI or XAUI, which is a 4-lane 10 gig signal, it's a 10 gig signal translated into 4 different lanes, well, then absolutely you do need a SerDes function. And sometimes those chips are called glue chips. You know, they're like glue, take one format, just convert it to another, allow me to glue this front panel port to this ASIC. They can have loads of different names, but the function that they carry out can be very different based on the layout of your board, or the components on your board, I should say.
Okay.
So, I mean, I would normally call them a framer. So it's this, if the SFP doesn't care if it's carrying Ethernet or Sonnet or any other kind of bitwise protocol.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the first bit of silicon here that knows about Ethernet framing and symbols and 64B, 66B encoding, all that kind of jazz. Mm-hmm. And so potentially things like, you know, OTN encoding, if it's going over a long reach, you know, optical link. And that lower level of the Ethernet framing is not in the ASIC, then yeah, you pull it out a separate chip. Pretty much everything between chip to chip these days is done serially, so you have a SerDes kind of on every bit of a chip to chip interface wherever you go across the board. So that's not specific to this.
Okay, so that leads us into one discussion, which is probably where we'll wrap it up for this week, which is this concept of fileless 10 gig interfaces. Now, I've seen this touted by several vendors as a way to save money by having fileless transceivers. Can you explain that?
So I can do my best.
I've often wondered what a fileless transceiver is. My understanding is that a lot of the actual PHY translation was done in the QSFP module itself. Fileless does it differently. Is that right?
It's difficult because it goes back to, once you say fileless, you've got to say, well, what's a PHY? You know, you've got to define the PHY. The PHY, you know, like we were saying, it is a function in the stack. It is the physical layer function or processing in the Ethernet stack. However, that was performed on a separate switch, or functions, parts of the PHY functionality were performed on that glue switch that did the serialization, deserialization, the signal conditioning and cleanup. When people are saying PHYless, from what I can find, from what I can see, and there's very little information on the net about this,
yeah,
is that they're saying, I no longer have a glue chip. I no longer have a signal conditioner between the front panel port and the ASIC. And what they're saying is by eliminating that signal conditioner, you know, I reduce power cost, power requirements, because you had one of these, or, you know, maybe one for every 8 ports, one for every 4 ports, etc. But you eliminate latency, you eliminate power consumption, and you just have a simpler platform. What's not clear is what the cost of doing that is. So one of the other functions in these chips, and this is why the name of these chips is so hard to pin down, is that there was a function called electronic dispersion compensation, or EDC. That is a really, Simon, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but from what I can gather, this is digital signal processing. It's got like a mini processor in that chip, in that signal conditioning chip, can sort out very complicated dispersion problems and really do an excellent job of cleaning up the signal. But when you ask the vendors what happens when you remove this PHY chip, in air quotes, the signal conditioning chip, you know, what's the cost? And the main cost is that you can't support an Ethernet function called LRM. So I think that's long reach multimode.
Right.
I mean, I don't know anybody who's using it. The idea of long reach multimode is that you can use a single mode laser on OM1 and OM2 fiber, so really old fiber plant, and I think you can get about 220 meters. You know, the reason we're using OM3 and OM4 at the moment is because it was designed for these longer distances and high speeds. It seems to me is what the vendors have been doing is they've said, we want to offer LRM. It's a 10 gig standard. We want to be compliant. And I think this is data sheet fun and games here. We want to be compliant with everything. The only way we can support every technology is by putting in one of these expensive signal conditioning chips. Now there's loads of other benefits for the vendor as well. They get to, the board layout is simpler because they have a signal conditioner, so they can get extra distance. So they're not just getting an EDC, they're getting simpler board layouts. But that's what I can gather on it, Greg. When you look at the list of transceivers that are no longer supported, once you go to a PHYless chip, the only thing that sticks out there for me is LRM, and I don't know anybody that uses it.
I know that Arista's done something in this space. They have they're using a PHYless design on their new 100 gig line card. And what they do, though, is that the line card comes with pre-configured SFPs on the board, and they're all, so you get 12 100 gig interfaces, short range, goes for a certain distance, and that's it. You can't, they're not replaceable. So maybe what they're doing is saying, well, if we pre-manufacture the QSFPs, you know, the gigabit physical interfaces straight on the board, we can take that chip out because we know what the electrical properties look like.
Yeah, that's you take control of the process. You can engineer it a little bit more tightly. I would love to hear from anybody, any listeners, etc., who could maybe bring a little bit more clarity to the whole PHYless thing. I've only just scratched the surface on this. It's important because people are touting, you know, people are selling PHYless, and we know that they're selling it based on reduced latency and reduced power. But I'd love to know a little bit more about the cost of PHYless.
Okay. Simon, do you know much about it, or shall we leave it and we see if people can come back to us by the time we record the next show?
No, I don't have much to add there.
Okay. Well, I think we might call it a bit of a wrap there. We've talked today about the ports and the transceivers and how there's some things about volatile memory and booting operating systems, and a little bit more about forwarding operating systems. We've got a few more topics to go, which will be in part 3. I don't think we'll get to part 4, but you never know. We've managed to turn this into 2 hours so far, so holy Hannah. There you go. So that's it for the show this week. Thanks, John, very much for joining us on the show again this week.
Thanks, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for putting this list of topics together, because it's kind of baffling. If somebody's listening and knows the difference between PHY and PHYless, get in contact with me at greg.farrow@packetpushers.net, and I'd love to hear about what you're going to say. Simon, thank you so much for joining us again this week.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Greg.
Really appreciate your input. It's I don't normally think about what goes on inside a switch linearly. I only learn it in bits and pieces, and I've had to put it together in my head. And so it's good to have this conversation. Of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can follow me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter as at etherealmind. Don't forget you can follow up with some show notes on the blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter, LinkedIn, Google+, and a range of other foul social media sites that steal your privacy and make sure that you don't own yourself or your identity, because that's what we do. And look forward to you coming back next week. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show. Please feel free to leave comments on the blog. Send us an email at packetpushers@gmail.com. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.